I'll just mention briefly
the case of a Chinese paleontologist who was in the States at a conference and talking to other paleontologists from this country. And in a given conversation, he suddenly discovered that there's a difference between China and America. And he said to the people there, you know, in China, we can't criticize the government, but we can criticize evolution. In the United States, you can't criticize evolution, you can criticize the government. And I think of our speaker yesterday at Missiology Time, he's held in the vice grip of a secular interpretation of events and of history. And the idea of any satanic involvement is just unthinkable. And in fact, in evangelical circles in general, the concept of Satan is unthinkable. Steve Plog mentioned the passage in Matthew 16 where Jesus refers to Peter as Satan. That's probably a mistranslation. The word Satan, all the way through the Bible practically, doesn't mean Satan, it means adversary. And so Jesus is saying to Peter, are you opposing what I'm saying? But by the time you get into the New Testament, more often than not, the word Satan is in fact a person, not just an adversary. And so it would be probably better to translate that passage without the word Satan in it, because in English, the word Satan never refers to an adversary. It always refers to a person. Well, so much for that. I promised on Wednesday that, or I should say yesterday, that I would say something about the Tokyo meetings. And I always like to give a little background to what I say. Let's start with 1500, okay? I'm presuming you're acquainted with what happened between 0 and 1500, and in fact between Abraham's day of 4,000 to 2,000 years B.C. And so we're leaving a lot of the picture out, but here we're just going to confine ourselves to 5 centuries, because that's all the time we have. Now, what happened in 1500 is a notable event. Okay. What about a Christian event? Reformation. In other words, for 1500 years, a particular version of Christianity, the Latin version called Catholic, had been getting along under the assumption that someday everyone in the world would speak Latin, everyone in the world would be Catholic. But in roughly 1500, a little bit after, that idea broke down and the Germanic sphere peeled off. And this was a great shock to the Catholic in the Latin tradition, and they're still to this day convinced that it shouldn't have happened. The idea that Christianity could be carried in different earthen vessels that were quite dissimilar but with the same content was just unthinkable to them. And to some it's not a big problem, but to the majority of Latin speaking Christians, I mean Latin tradition Christians, it's still a great tragedy. However, long before 1500, the idea of the Great Commission was clearly understood. In 1210, the Dominicans were quoting the Great Commission and saying that their job encompassed the globe. But of course, in 1200, they had no way to get out there. And by 1492, they did have a way to get out there. And so the Catholic tradition had a growing and large, significant missionary movement up until here. And what happened here? The French Revolution was not only disturbance in France, but in all of Europe, and essentially demolished the entire Catholic missionary movement. At the same time, the British Empire was coming into being, and we have William Carey here, who was a brilliant but rustic small town, maybe village believer, who went to India. But before he did, he was very concerned about the slaves in the Caribbean and refused to buy sugar, along with many people in England at that time, boycotting the sugar industry precisely because it was mistreating human beings in the Caribbean. And after he got to India, he wrote a letter back to a member of Parliament urging him to join the Abolition of Slaves Committee, which had been formed by the year 1800. He always had, his mind was moving in all kinds of directions. And among other things, in 1800, he was already in India by that time, he said, you know, there should be a world conference of missionaries from all over the world. And why don't we gather in Cape Town in 1810? Now, 1810 was a meeting that did not happen, but it was a meeting that was conceived. And it was part of a significant vision. A lot of things happened, of course. Things are boiling up. Not only the population of the world is skyrocketing, but Christian activities in missions are much more complex. The Catholics pretty much withdrew by this time. The Protestants began from scratch after 300 years of hibernation, where they woke up to the Great Commission because of this village kid who read the Bible. And within 200 years, the Protestants caught up with the Catholics, who already had an immense empire of followers around the world. And by 1910, there was finally, William Carey's vision came to pass. There was a meeting, global in scope, representing all parts of the world, a meeting of not church leaders, but of mission leaders. Now, this is a very unique kind of a situation. There were quite a few church leaders, you know, Christian statesmen, who felt left out of the meeting. The idea being, why aren't we involved? You know, we're the church. But nevertheless, in 1910, probably the most significant meeting in mission history took place in terms of later influence and so forth. William Carey's meeting didn't happen, but he wrote a little book which became the most influential book ever written to this day on the subject of missions. And this was the most significant conference in history to this day in its influence on missions. But the idea of just mission executives getting together, which, if you stop to think of it, when church leaders get together, in fact, this is usually true. The agenda of the meeting is, do we believe in the supremacy of Christ? Is he different from all the religions? Do we believe in the Bible? You know, stuff like that. I would say rudimentary stuff like that. When missionaries get together, hey, they don't have any trouble with things like that. They're not arguing about whether Christ was God's son. They're not arguing about whether the Bible is true or not. The vast majority of all missionaries have really been true believers, and they talk about strategy, how to get the job done, rather than what is the job. So in any case, this meeting was held. No one ever thought that there should ever be another meeting like it until 1972. In 1972, a Southern Baptist professor at a meeting of professors at which I was attending, I came back from Guatemala in 66, he said, look, let's have another meeting like the 1910 meeting in 1980. This was 8 years ahead of time. He said, you know, the idea came up 8 years in advance. So he said, why don't we have a meeting in 1980? Well, that's a very fascinating story. I was remembering last night that I wrote an article some years ago, about in 1979, entitled "The Precarious Milestones to 1980," because the idea of a global meeting, there's nobody to sponsor it. The United Nations isn't going to sponsor it. The U.S. government isn't going to sponsor it. Who's going to sponsor a global meeting of everybody? There isn't any body that can do that. There was no World Council even in those days. The World Evangelical Alliance had fallen to pieces at that point. So in any case, this meeting almost didn't happen, but it did happen. And actually, I don't usually want to take credit for things, but our group here had a great deal to do with the fact that it did happen. The runner-up meetings to it, planning meetings, took place in this room. Mission agencies from all over Southern California participated. And 50 of our staff actually attended the meeting in Edinburgh in 1980. And there's a whole book on that subject called Seeds of Promise, which we'd like to publish. Is David Bogosian in here? No. Okay. We're going to try to reprint that book in the next 3 weeks, and time for its existence to be announced in the January issue of Mission Frontiers, which will come out in December. And and that meeting had tremendous fallout. There are all kinds of things going on around the world which now we have no control over whatsoever, which represent that, the unreached people's perspective. I have a document here of a group called Ethne to Ethne, subtitled Peoples Joining Together to Glorify God Among All Peoples, Reaching the Unreached, Reach Completely. And it says 28% of the world's peoples are members of ethne with little or no access to the gospel. And in a two-page document, I don't know when it was written or who wrote it or what. Keith, you know a little more about ethne maybe than others here. Who in the sun?
Kent, I think his name is. And Park, yeah, he's been one of the key members of that movement.
Well, in any case, we have nothing to do with it, but Greg Parsons did attend their meeting in Bali last year. But we're just glad that the idea has caught on and that we are no longer the ones who have to push it. I used to say we in the early years, trying to buy this campus and all that, we were a very slim a team here. I mean, we started out with three people and gradually grew, and everybody and his brother was telling us what you're doing is not going to happen. And there were people telling people on our board, you should get off the board before this thing sinks and all that sort of stuff. So we were very, very limp, even as late as 1980. But we did participate in that meeting. And it was a very significant meeting. Well, now, 100 years later, 200 years later than 1810, 100 years later than 1910, there's another meeting planned. I'm missing a point here. In 2002, I should draw them. There was a meeting in Singapore that Tim Lewis and Greg Parsons together, and plus a few others, squirreled together, which brought together missions interested in unreached peoples. There were about 100 people present, and okay, 134. I never like to exaggerate. What? Okay, 234. See how modest I was when I said 100 people. And they had a process of discussing what ought to happen in missions. A very interesting, complex group dynamics process, which led from smaller groups to larger groups and larger groups, and finally the whole group, and then priorities. And the number one priority was to form a global organization that would try to coordinate mission efforts. But after the meeting, no one did anything. And so by 2004, we squirreled together a follow-through meeting to form such an organization called the Global Network of Mission Structures. If you look on the website under GNMS.org, you'll find some other strange organization by that, so the same initials. If you look at GNMS.com, you'll find another organization with those strange initials. You have to look at GNMS.net, then you will find the list of people who attended the meeting in Amsterdam and all the purposes. And one of those purposes listed is to convene a meeting in 2010, which would be similar to the meeting in 1910. Now, we're not the only ones in the world who are aware of the significance of the 1910 meeting. I would say most evangelicals are not aware of it because coming out of that meeting indirectly, the World Council came out of it. Therefore, it gives a bad name to the 1910 meeting. So evangelicals don't usually talk about it, but others do. There are three other meetings, in fact, in 2010, commemorating the 1910 meeting. One of them is in Edinburgh itself. It was originally going to be a meeting of 60 or 70 scholars, mainly, convened by the University of Edinburgh. But somehow they got the idea of making it bigger. Now it's going to be maybe 800. They're inviting people all over the world, mainly church leaders, some mission leaders. And we have a stake in that meeting in the sense that they have an atlas of global Christianity that's under production, which we will never buy. It's going to cost $250. And to use geography to describe humanity is more and more of a useless process because people aren't where they're supposed to be. They're moving all over the world. Millions and millions of people are no longer at home. Turkmen, for instance, of Turkmenistan, more than half of them are not in the country. But anyway, they're going to do it. We put in $5,000, and we're happy for that meeting. Then there is another meeting that we convene in Boston. It's not actually directly connected to the 1910 meeting, except in the sense that after the 1910 meeting, they sense the absence of younger people. So some seminaries in Boston, today mainly liberal seminaries, got together a global meeting of students. And they want to have a commemorative 100-year-later meeting in Boston. And so that's the second of the three additional meetings. The third meeting will be the largest of all. It'll be the Lausanne-sponsored meeting. Guess where? Cape Town. There it's distinctly remembering William Carey's proposal of meeting in Cape Town. It's probably the most expensive place in the world to go, but nevertheless, they have millions of dollars behind them, and the Lausanne meeting in Cape Town will be a very significant meeting. The Lausanne Committee these days is actually headed up by a missionary, which is a novel development because it's always been headed up by church people, but it will still mainly invite church people. The Lausanne tradition is a tradition to try to evangelize church leaders on the subject of evangelism. They don't use the word mission because missions, in Billy Graham's perspective, is a kind of an imperialistic word. It involves people from outside a country pressing into a country.
So when I gave my talk in 1974, at the first of the Lausanne meetings, in my manuscript, the word mission was crossed out in every single case.
And the word evangelism was put in there, because evangelism is supposedly not to be that imperialistic. But nevertheless, it will be a significant mission meeting, despite the fact that it will not mainly be a mission meeting. So here you have three meetings. The Edinburgh itself meeting, sponsored by a university, drawing mainly upon World Council people, but on lots of other people as well. They have invited Salvation Army and Pentecostal leaders and stuff like that. Like I say, mainly church leaders. There will be the students meeting in Boston. There will be the Cape Town meeting in sponsored by Lausanne and jointly sponsored, by the way, by the WEA, the World Evangelical Alliance. So what room is there for another meeting, a fourth meeting? Well, the fourth meeting is actually the first that was announced. It's a repetition of the kind of a meeting that took place in 1910. Very simply, it's a meeting of mission executives. Now, in the evening, it will be a celebration, a separate meeting run by the pastors of Tokyo or Japan, open to the public. That will not be connected to the daytime meeting. But the daytime meeting will be a meeting of mission executives. Nobody will be invited, like in 1910. Nobody was invited. The only people present were those who were delegated, mission agencies that had enough missionaries to be counted, like, I don't know, 10 or more, were urged to send delegates, and according to their size, how many delegates. And so they had about 1,050 people at the meeting in 1910. All of them were sent by mission executives, mission agencies. Now, that doesn't mean there were no church people there, because, for example, the Church Missionary Society working in South India, they chose a bishop of South India to go to the meeting, Bishop Azariah. They didn't notice that he had himself founded two mission societies and could have gone as a representative of those mission agencies, but the people in the West were the ones running the world in those days, and it didn't even occur to them that the mission field Christians could launch their own mission society. This is probably the greatest hiatus of the 1910 meeting. But it wasn't intentional. It was just an accidental tragedy. So anyway, the meeting in Tokyo will be mission executives from all over the world. In 1900, as I say, not a single third world agency was represented, although there were two in India and one in the Solomon Islands that I know of. In 1980, one third of all the delegates came from third world agencies, from 37 different agencies. The largest group of third world agencies ever to gather up to that point in history. The meeting in 2010 will probably be two-thirds world representatives, with a Western contingent in the minority, so that there are these differences and so forth. Now, talk about the precarious milestones of 1980. I don't have the time to tell you all the reasons why this meeting is precarious. We found out a few more in Japan, but that'll have to be for another day. I just want you to realize what's going on and our involvement. A number of us are involved in the planning and the development of the 2010 meeting. Bruce, especially, in sending out emails to the various agencies of the world, letting them know. The January issue of the Mission Frontiers was determined yesterday to be on this meeting. It'll say, what does it say? I can't remember the cover slogan. But there will be four meetings mentioned. All four meetings that I've mentioned will be on the cover. And of course, we'll try to give friendly coverage to all four meetings. But we'll try to distinguish clearly the 2:10 meeting so that people don't realize. Oh, there's one other thing to mention quickly. On the 10th of November, the representatives of all four meetings will be meeting in Boston. And there is a good feeling between the people, partly because the Lausanne Committee is now headed up by a student that I helped derange his life. And he went from pastor to missions, Doug Birdsall, and he's very friendly. And the Edinburgh meeting, my son-in-law is involved as actually the editor of the Atlas of World Christianity, which we're not going to buy. the $250 monument. It's a scholarship. But we have no connections at all to the fourth meeting, the one in Boston, except that my son-in-law is also involved in that meeting indirectly. So we'll find out more when we meet together on November 10th. But these are things to pray about because, you know, there is a Bible verse, I'm not sure what passage it is, probably in Proverbs, out of sight, out of mind. It's got to be in the Bible someplace. Global meetings are out of sight for most people. I came to a very strange and shocking conclusion last night as I was thinking about all this. I said to myself, you know, ants walking all around, there are ants, different kinds of ants, all over the world, and they're almost always on the ground. And they outnumber human beings, not only in number, but even in weight. If you would weigh all the ants in the world, they would weigh more than all the human beings in the world. They did a test on that. They weighed all the ants, and they weighed all the but among ants, there are very few astronomers. Take my word for it. You can look it up in the Wikipedia. There are very few astronomers among ants. Now, I'm not sure which part of the Bible this comes from, but it's obvious that the average believer is like an ant walking around. He can see only so far and doing his thing, industrious, dedicated, serious person. But what's going on in the rest of the world is really not within the ken of the average ant. And there are very few ants that are astronomers. Remember that. You may not have thought of that. there are very few believers who are aware of or interested in global meetings or global organizations. I have to tell you that I am not as interested in the 2010 meeting as I am interested in the GNMS, which is an ongoing structure. And one of the amazing and wonderful things is that just in the last week, we got the confirmation from the entire GNMS board, executive board, that they are approving, as an international director for the GNMS, a man from Korea named Young Cho. A young man with a PhD. He has been the head of the Global Partners Organization over there. He's rotating out of that job. On the 1st of November, he'll be free. Half of his time will be free to work for the GNMS. And this is a very significant development. Tim Lewis actually sent me an email saying, well, you really landed somebody when you did that. And that was because we were in Korea a few months ago, 2 weeks ago, and we talked to the right people. We talked to the same people in Wheaton at the Korean Congress there. It's all a matter of personal relationships, really. And we're just very delighted that he'll be able to take that job. Now, the GNMS is only one of the sponsors of the 2010 meeting. But, and this I close with this, if the 2010 meeting is successful, and it is obvious that it will be, it's a precarious milestones thing, you know. If it is successful, then the GNMS will be much stronger than otherwise. And in my opinion, what happens between meetings is more important than what happens at meetings. What happens at meetings can only be significant if it affects what happens between meetings. And so we're looking forward to the GNMS. By the way, how many of you know what GNMS stands for? Okay. You look on the web, you'll find lots of other reasons, lots of other interpretations of that acronym. The Global Network of Mission Structures. Many tasks today cannot be done except on a global level. The peoples of the world are on the move, have been on the move for a long time. They're moving more rapidly than ever today. And it's as if at a certain point in the future, there will be no such a thing as countries. Everybody will be spread all around and mixed up. It's just like mixing up beans of different colors in a bowl. they're all mixed up. There's no one part of the bowl where you say these are black beans, because the black beans are everywhere. Now, I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime, but we're moving in that direction, and it means that the only way to look at the world is global. And like I've often said, the Turkmen are in 14 countries. Almost half of them are not in their own country. And many other countries, that's even more obvious. Yes, Rick?
1910 had a huge research component where they interviewed missionaries all over the world. What are you doing and what are you learning and what's working and what's not working, which surely you can't do in 2010. But I mean, that's what made it so significant, wasn't it? Was there was such a broad input. I mean, can we ever imagine something like that from all these GNMS organizations somehow getting grassroots input? It was not a bunch of executives.
This is one of the reasons for the November 10th meeting, to find out who's doing what and to try to collaborate. And together, I think the Edinburgh people already have the same 8 subjects, plus one more or two more, that they're producing books for. I actually think that the impact of the 1910 meeting wasn't so much what was written, because nobody reads anymore, but it was the very fact that all these different groups got together at one place at one time. There was no significant cleavage at that meeting apart from Protestant Catholic. And that's what electrified the global church, and that's what then catalyzed the World Council of Churches. Came out of that meeting, not directly, but indirectly. Yeah.
Why did the 1810 meeting not happen?
Well, it's because the board of directors of Carey's mission said to one another, they said, isn't this just one more pleasing dream of William Carey? They considered it a dream. And of course, there were huge obstacles to that. But anyway, the idea was just ridiculous to most people. In fact, it's ridiculous to most people to this day. We just don't have lots of people who are going to bed at night praying about the 2010 meeting or the GNMS. You know, these things are out of sight, out of mind. Like I say, remember, very few answer astronomers.